For 40 years, the anthropologist Professor Peter Sutton has been working on issues like Aboriginal art, Aboriginal language and land rights. His new book, The Politics of Suffering, argues that the liberal consensus of the last three decades on Aboriginal disadvantage has collapsed. Professor Sutton set out to know why the suffering in so many Aboriginal communities seemed to keep getting worse. I spoke to him about today's report to the nation's leaders.
The gap seems to be widening most in remote Australia and semi-remote Australia. But then some gaps are closing, so we shouldn't forget that.
But what's going on where it is getting worse? Why is it getting worse?
I think you can see some things that are more or less easily explainable. One is the increasing number of women being incarcerated. I think that would have to be directly related to the increasing use of alcohol by women in remote areas. 10, 20, 30 years ago, depending on the place, you didn't ever see women drinking in remote areas. Men did, young men tended to, old men often didn't. Then older men began to, and teenagers, and then young women, and then eventually older women. I watched it creep through communities in some remote places where I've lived for a long time. What's happening there is the spread of the phenomenon through the population, from beginning with one gender and moving onto women.
What's your feeling then about bans on alcohol?
That certainly was the way many of the remote communities preferred to have things in the past, and many of them prefer to have it now. There are those who've had it imposed on them, not on a racial basis, but on a community basis, although obviously with most people there being Aboriginal, it sort of looks racial. But there's a big debate, it always has been, about whether banning alcohol produces more slygrog running versus having a wet canteen or a tavern which is open a few hours each day selling weak beer, whether that will make people happy enough to go without the slygrog. I don't know of any comprehensive sort of study of that.
When we talk about child abuse, an enormous amount of that problem is about violence. And in your book, you trace a history, a very, very long history of violence against children and against women. Are you saying that it is ingrained in their culture?
No, just a short correction there. There's no evidence of children being abused in any significant degree in the archaeological record. There's a scientific study of a very large sample of skeletal remains.
I'm sorry, I was referring to the area where you were talking about this practice of crueling, the pinching of babies, sometimes so hard that their skin breaks and may go septic.
Yes, that would be defined as child abuse in terms of the law, probably, and certainly in terms of the mores of most cultures in the world, but it wasn't and still isn't in remote parts of Australia regarded as a bad thing. It's part of how you deal with small children, and it's customary, and people don't sit and discuss it. They just do it, and their grannies did it, and their great-grannies did it, and their uncles did it. But in general, the evidence about what was going on before Captain Cook is that women and men were receiving very high levels, percentage-wise, of injuries to the skull and injuries to the body, particularly defensive injuries. But there's no evidence of children having any bone injuries of that sort at all.
You don't believe in cultural relativism. You're critical of it. So how does one make a transition from a culture of violence?
I'm sceptical about cultural relativism, and I'm also, I think it has its place and time, relatively speaking. But people don't usually change fundamental practices in a particular society by committee or by sitting around and having chats with a psychologist. Things like that tend to shift by changes in more fundamental things like how families are structured, how children are reared, relationships between men and women, whether they're very antagonistic or distant, or whether there's an ideal of affection in marriage and all that sort of thing.
You say that one of the things that must be aimed at is for Aboriginal children to become more mobile, so that they have the option of staying where they are or moving to the city or whatever, being part of one society or the other. Are any policies that are in force now working towards that ideal?
Yes, there is encouragement of mobility, and there's encouragement of what some people call orbiting, that is having a remote community as a base but not treating it as the only place you live, moving in and out of it for work, for other reasons, education. There's a lot of private activity as well as government activity in the area of hosting children from remote communities in towns and cities where they're put up either in a boarding school or they actually lodge with privately with the family and go to school outside, which gives them at least the option to take up a different way of life or to include that way of life in their spectrum. But as it is, if they're stuck on the ghettos, what Marcia Langton calls the gulags, if they don't go outside them, if they don't go to school much, if they don't learn to deal with people other than their own relatives, they then become not just immobilised in terms of skills. It's a waste of time worrying too much about skills. Even completely illiterate people have the skill to survive in a city. What's missing for those young people now who haven't been dealing with the real world outside of their small areas is emotional mobility, the ability to keep your soul together as well as your body in a city, and find accommodation and not be overwhelmed by the emotional problems of relatives all wanting to come and stay and all that sort of thing. Or if you get into a fight with your boyfriend or girlfriend in Woolworths in the cosmetic section, what do? You throw a bottle at them, as you might feel free to do in a remote place, where such emotional displays are considered your business, or at least between the two of you? Or do you get away from that and actually become a member of a civic society where that sort of behaviour is not accepted?
This report shows a widening gap. The Rudd government has promised to close the gap. Do you think they have a chance to do it?
I'm not sure that governments can close gaps by action in this context other than tweaking things around the edges. And I wish it were otherwise. I have the view that in the short term these interventions are necessary, or at least most of them are, but in the long term that the best action would be to actually withdraw government from interfering so much with people's lives and racially structuring the community so that there are developing two nations in a way that we haven't actually had before, or at least not on the scale that we've had before in the last 30 or 40 years.
Professor Peter Sutton of the University of Adelaide, whose new book is The Politics of Suffering, Indigenous Australia and the End of the Liberal Consensus.